Welcome to the Best Science Medicine Podcast, BS without the BS.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to the 435th episode of the Best Science Medicine Podcast. My name is James McCormack, and I'm a professor with the Faculty of Pharmaceutical Sciences at the University of British Columbia.
I'm Mike Allen. I'm a family doctor and the director of Program and Practice Support at the College of Family Physicians of Canada and a professor at the University of Alberta.
And Mike, this is now our 435th podcast, and I think it's really interesting that I don't believe we've ever discussed one of the most common medications prescribed.
The most common medication prescribed, and we haven't mentioned it.
And we're not going to say what it is yet because we're going to keep people on tenterhooks here.
And but it's not a statin.
It's not a statin.
It's not metformin.
Not exercise.
That would be the most important thing prescribed, but it's not the most common thing prescribed.
But we've avoided like the plague probably almost as much as we is looking at protein in urine. But one of the most common prescriptions is thyroid.
For levothyroxine or Synthroid, if you like. If you have questions at the end of this podcast, I encourage you to send them in to James McCormack, and I'll be changing my email address.
Yes, exactly. So as with all of these things, these are always, they're always controversial in that, you will hear the extremes of how unbelievably everybody should be on it and then how nobody should be on it. And what we're going to do is sort of work you through just a recent tools for practice on the whole concept of how do you figure out things to do with THS. TSA. Good grief.
TSA.
Yeah, TSA. TSH screening and subclinical hypothyroidism because you and I'm just having a look here.
Jennifer.
You and Jennifer.
Jennifer Young.
Put together, I think, a really good overview of the best available evidence around this area. And because so many people take thyroid replacement, I think hopefully the audience will enjoy this. So why don't you start us off there, Mike?
So first of all, a little bit about Jennifer. Jennifer is the president of the Ontario College right now, but her background is actually in working in a program called Practicing Wisely. And she did a lot to bring that program forward. It's an Ontario program that's spreading across the country. And Practicing Wisely, one of the big parts of it is how we overorder and all of those kind of things. And a big part of that is hypothyroid and thyroid disease period, like scans for nodules and that kind of stuff. So anyhow, you guys can look up Practicing Wisely and all of that kind of stuff. At another, maybe we'll bring Jennifer in and some of her team to go over it. Team members like Jobin and that kind of thing. Anyhow, let's get to this question for today, which is, is there evidence for screening for thyroid function or treating subclinical hypothyroidism? And this comes out of my other work where I've done research into what tests are ordered for the periodic health exam and or the complete physical, if you like. And TSH is one of those that comes up, and it comes up whether you're in Canada or the U.S. as something that gets relatively regularly ordered.
Yeah. Well, a number of guidelines recommend that, that even asymptomatic adults, if you're over age 35, you measure it every 5 years.
Yeah. So, wow. Okay. Let's get to the evidence.
I'm going to add one other little piece of information. In the United Kingdom, 25% of adults have their thyroid function tested every year.
Yeah. And some of those will have hypothyroidism.
Oh, absolutely.
And beyond Synthroid, et cetera, and actually it's reasonable. We looked at, I remember one of our residents one time doing an exercise where they looked at what's the evidence for the frequency of testing of thyroid once you're on thyroid replacement, and there was really nothing. Yeah. And the best they could come up with is once a year, because that's generally what everyone does.
Right.
And then if it's abnormal, of course, much different frequency, but once it's in range, once a year.
Yeah.
But let's get to the healthy people who generally have no symptoms, and this is where things get fuzzy, the no symptoms thing, because I don't know, James, are you tired? Do you ever feel tired?
Only when I'm on the podcast with you.
So that's
what. But then along with that goes constipation, dry skin, and so on.
Fuzzy thinking.
Yeah.
So a lot of people feel some of the symptoms are vague, and it's hard to sort out sometimes. So it's not unreasonable to test in there, but recognizing that those are vague symptoms, and we'll come back to that. But this is patients like, hi, how are you doing? I'm feeling good. Okay, let's test the following things on you. And so is there evidence to screen? That means there's no complaints or no concerns. Is there evidence to screen for thyroid function? Mm-hmm. And the answer is no randomized controlled trials or controlled observational studies have actually looked at screening for thyroid function and the use of TSH test in screening. So there's a really large gap there if you're a believer in screening for thyroid function.
And by large gap, you mean there's nothing. I mean, I don't know if you can get much of a larger gap than that.
There's that all the way to now what's left is expert opinion, and you take in other observational data that people with elevated TSHs that is untreated right. end up doing worse on certain things. There's a whole bunch of reasons why that might be that has nothing to do with their thyroid because they're being untreated and unmanaged. So there might be other reasons there. But anyhow, that there is really no research to screen for it. Let's talk about the next step, which is what about treating subclinical hypothyroidism? So this is vaguely defined, but basically it's a TSH between 4 and 10 with really minimal symptoms or no clear symptoms, and TSH T4 that is normal. Mm-hmm. So now we could debate this for the remainder of the podcast, but James, if you're willing to accept that definition, I'm willing to move on.
I am willing to accept it for now.
You're so giving. It must be Christmas.
It is. And that's all. Okay. And that is all you're getting.
Okay, clinical endpoints. 4 systematic reviews have looked at this with between 18 and 21 randomized controlled trials from the last 5 years. And the treatment for subclinical hypothyroidism with levothyroxine, typically that's what it's done, versus placebo has no effect on mortality or new cardiovascular disease, the quality of life, depression scores, fatigue scores, or thyroid-related symptom scores. No effect on cognitive function, and here's one of the biggies, no effect on BMI or weight, which right. many people assume is
exactly.
the cause of their concerns. And then there's a very new RCT that was just published in, I think, JAMA, with 250 elderly people, mean age 85, and they found no benefit in them on any outcome over 1.5 years of follow-up. Yeah.
And so that's pretty, and that's pretty much all of the things that thyroid is supposed to help.
Yeah, like it's
that runs the gamut, you know, from all the way from obviously mortality, and then, you know, there is a thought that, you know, cardiovascular disease is associated with it, and then all of the symptoms and so on and so forth. So it's not like it's been unstudied. Now, not every one of these studies was, 5 years in duration where they followed mortality in detail and cardiovascular disease. But again, there's just not much there.
No, there's not. And it's important because, you're right. The studies some of them aren't really big to look at this, but it has been looked at. And you're really looking over every possible clinical endpoint that could matter. Mm-hmm. And there's not a shred of benefit in these clinical trials. So what are we left with? We're left with surrogate markers, which is important to some people. So let's talk about surrogate markers.
Yeah, yeah. And just to put it into context, one of the reasons that it is much easier for clinical trials to show differences in things like the blood pressure and lipids is because they're easier studies to do. You do them for a much shorter period of time. And so that's why we sometimes get, people who listen to the podcast know we have issues with surrogate markers, but that's one of the main reasons is that we see so much evidence in these areas is because they're much easier to do. You could do a blood pressure or lipid one in, 2 months.
Yeah. And the other thing about these, and it's true of some of the other findings, like everyone will have a BMI or a weight to report. Mm-hmm. Everyone will have a cognitive function to report if it was done in the trial. Right. But like this blood pressure, everyone will have a BP to report. Where in mortality and cardiovascular disease, they're underpowered because not everyone has mortality, thank goodness.
No, exactly.
But let's get to BP. So, and this is the arguments that some people use for treating it because there is some research about reductions, but when you actually start to look at it, you'll find it's very inconsistent. So three systematic reviews found no effect on either systolic or diastolic blood pressure. But one found a systolic blood pressure reduction of 2.5 millimeters of mercury with no statistically different change in diastolic. So that's it. One out of four found a tiny change. I would consider 2.5 a tiny change.
Yeah, I mean, it's tricky because, you know, we most of the clinical trials that look at benefit from treating high blood pressure, if you reduce the blood pressure's systolics by, you know, 5, 6, you know, you might be seeing impacts on outcome.
And certainly when you're getting at 10 and those kind of things, that's when it's...
Yeah, so like 2.5 is not, it's not, you know, it has possibilities, but it's not an impressive reduction by any stretch of the imagination.
Yeah, and nothing in diastolic and nothing in this is, you know, 25% of the systematic reviews found that versus 75% that didn't. So take that for what it's worth, which I don't think the evidence base is poor and it's in a surrogate marker. So adding those together comes up with a big zero to me. But anyhow, so with four systematic reviews, two found, this is for lipids, sorry, this is for lipids now. There were four systematic reviews, two found no effect, but two found that they changed either total cholesterol or LDL by either 0.1 to all the way up to 0.6 millimoles per liter with no change in HDL or triglycerides. Yeah. So what does that mean? Goodness only knows. It's not big changes by any stretch, but it's changes that you might see with some of the poorer agents, particularly when it's talking in the 0.6 range. But again, others didn't find it, and we don't find differences in cardiovascular disease or mortality or anything like that. So if these changes are real, it doesn't appear to be translating into something that's clinically meaningful.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's becoming quite clear to me why, you know, thyroid is the number one medication. I mean,
because it's effective for so many things.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, remember, this is subclinical hypothyroid.
No.
So that's a discussion we can have a little bit as we go on, but it's tricky for subclinical. So if you're arguing you're trying to pick up early disease when you're screening, like subclinical, then you're probably not doing anyone significant or meaningful benefit because the changes are very, they're either non-existent if you look at clinical things and at best iffy in surrogate markers.
Yeah.
So it's hard to argue for screening unless we were finding people with profound disease that was somehow not clinically noticeable.
Exactly. And I agree. And what you're saying is, and again, looking at some of the numbers around, you know, TSH levels, you know, about 90% of all patients with subclinical hypothyroidism have TSH levels between around 4 and 10, which is what you were talking about. But, you know, there's pretty good evidence that about 2/3 of those without any intervention normalize over about 5 years. So, and we'll get into that a little bit about the measurement of TSH in just a minute. But
well, yeah, let's start that, James, because I got this data from somebody who many people will think is insane. Again, at the best of times, insane.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And wrong most of the time. So James,
no, all of the time.
Often wrong, but never in doubt.
Yeah.
No, so James has done a ton of work on this stuff with looking at all sorts of tests, and this is just one of them. So TSH, and I got this data from you that it fluctuates, you know, 26% on a daily basis. That was from one study.
Yeah.
And then from yours, individually, it can fluctuate 50% the value.
Yeah. And this is stuff that we're going to be getting published in the BMJ in just a little bit. And we did some did this with Dan Holmes, who's just a great lab guy here in Vancouver. And it's important for people to realize that the TSH, the analytical test is pretty good. I mean, it's you know, plus minus about 5 to 10%. But the biggest problem is all of the biologic variation. And so just so people are aware of this. Before you can confidently say that the TSH has changed over time, it has to have changed at least 40 to 50%. Otherwise, you may just be seeing the biologic variation. So that it's one of the.
There is a second solution, James.
What's that?
To that problem?
Yes.
The tests, the number of tests. You can explain that. How might you help yourself narrow the the variability.
Yeah, if you were to do 4 TSH tests before doing anything, like on one day, average those and then do some intervention or wait or whatever, and then do another 4 at a later time, you can reduce that variation by about a half. But you're still, but you're still looking at, and no one's going to do that, but you're still looking at, you know, a 25% change before you can be comfortable that it's changed. So there's a whole bunch of issues around the measurement that make it very tricky. And probably that's one of the reasons why if you just leave it alone, it'll come back to in quotation marks, normal.
Right. And that's part of the thing, the other study that I was mentioning, where it's fluctuating just 26% on the average day for an individual. Mm-hmm. And then you start to add other variables in, and, you know, the variance in the test becomes quite large. And so that's an important piece. And just as you said, the people with subclinical hypothyroidism, 40% of them will normalize in 2.5 years or so. So after 2.5 years, almost half of them will be back to normal.
Yeah. And you, as a clinician, it's impossible for you to really pick up, was the first one that I got true or not? You know, it's so tricky.
In clinical medicine, James, a lot of what we do is we test until it's normal and then stop.
Oh, immediately stop. Yeah, no, that's why. Yeah, if you've ever got a type 2 diabetic, once they get, you know, once their A1C becomes normal, just never test it again.
Yeah, have negative health consequences.
No, but you know what I'm saying? I'm exaggerating to make a point, but yeah.
I absolutely know. Yeah, I agree. That was the kind of joke.
Like, yeah, especially if you're being paid to get people to certain numbers.
Yeah, I remember. Oh, yes, that's right. I remember that as a medical student, when one of the residents saying to me, is that normal yet? And I think it was at the time, and I remember him saying emphatically, then don't test it ever again.
Yeah, exactly.
So what's the prevalence of subclinical hypothyroidism in the developed world? So it's somewhere between 4 and 10%, and about 2 to 6% may progress on to overt hypothyroidism. Mm-hmm. Remember, another 40% or so will revert back to euthyroidism, or normal thyroid levels. And so it's a real, you're stuck when you find it, because you kind of have to follow it intermittently for a while to see what's happening, to make sure it's not shifting over. But once my patients, in my experience, once they shift back, I don't retest it then, because it's a bit of a nightmare to follow anyway, and they keep wondering why they're getting blood tests. For subclinical hyperthyroidism, the prevalence is somewhere around 2%, and 1% to 2% will go on to develop overt hyperthyroidism in a number of years. So it's got a higher rate of progression than subclinical hypothyroidism. And let's talk a tiny bit about symptoms, because they're a bugbear for us. And the fact is that... many people are tired. We joked about that at the beginning, and many people have. And I was saying to James before the podcast started about, you know, dry skin. Who in Canada doesn't have dry skin, at least in the winter, and so on. So it's and many people suffer from intermittent constipation, and many people are unhappy about their weight, and so you can quickly pile on things that you think might be related to your thyroid function. And so, like many of us, I've ended up testing people and then ended up finding, and generally at their request for a lot of these kind of things.
And they're going to be requesting these sort of tests because, you know, there's just a lot of magazines out there that, you know, when you look at the front page of it, it says, you know, treatment for your, if you're hypothyroid, what foods do you eat? What exercises can you do for your thyroid?
And you have to normalize your thyroid. Can you imagine what foods do you eat? Yeah. You eat more navel oranges, for goodness sake. Noah.
Yeah. But you know what I'm saying? It's front and center. And because what they're doing is sort of going after the, if you don't feel perfect, it could be your thyroid.
Yeah. And certainly it is kind of a panacea problem. So that might be all of my woes, my kind of feeling fatigued, feeling down. And I don't blame people for wondering, God, no. You know, is there something out there that could fix all of this for me in one fell swoop? But a lot of it has to do with other things. And I think this study was really useful. And what it did is it looked at a whole bunch of people and kind of looked at their thyroid symptoms. and compared it to where they were on the TSH blood test. And what it found was, if you took people who had at least four symptoms for hypothyroidism, so things like fatigue and dry skin and all of that kind of thing, if you took that and they had at least four different symptoms for hypothyroidism, you would find that present in 18% of those with euthyroid, in other words, with absolutely normal thyroid function, 22% with those with subclinical hypothyroidism, and 26% of those with overt hypothyroidism.
Right.
So the difference is small. You start out at euthyroid, 18% of people feel they have four or more symptoms that would be associated with hypothyroidism. And so that to me is a very telling statistic. So even when you take the 26% of patients with overt hypothyroidism having those four symptoms, 18% of people with euthyroid would also describe the same problem. Yeah. So
and interesting, you know, 75% of overt hypothyroid patients don't have that.
Yeah, they don't have those symptoms. It's fascinating.
Yeah.
Right? So it's hard to do clinically. So don't feel bad if you say to yourself, man, am I ordering this too much because I have these complaints? Because it's not easy to sort out. But I guess the biggest thing here is don't be tempted to to immediately order a TSH on. First of all, don't order TSHs on everyone who comes through the door regardless, because I don't think that that will end in improvement in care for patients. And the evidence certainly doesn't support that. But also recognize the challenge of that a lot of these complaints are pervasive even in patients with normal thyroid function. And so it becomes very difficult to sort out I'm sure listeners here have started Synthroid on patients, got their thyroid normal, and they haven't been satisfied with or they don't feel that their symptoms have resolved adequately on therapy. And I get that, and that's because of some of these issues. So just keep this in mind when you're managing this problem. And if you're like me, you avoid treating subclinical hypothyroidism, but you can also probably look back on your patients and thought once or twice where maybe, you know, you've been at 8 and 9 and you've certainly been complaining about a lot of fatigue. Mm-hmm. Would it help? Blah, blah, blah. And I've done that once or twice in my career. And I can tell you it didn't help either patients, but I can understand why you might think it's worth a shot because this patient is suffering for so long. And I don't think that that's necessarily a wrong thing, I think, but it should be the nuanced, rare patient before you consider that versus the standard, because treating subclinical hypothyroidism in clinical trials has consistently shown no positive effect.
And I think and what we really hope people do with the things like the tools of practice is to become somewhat sort of knowledgeable about what the evidence is so that you can have that conversation, you know, because, you know, it's hard just to say, oh, well, you know, I read this thing once and it said, oh, you just don't do it. Or I read this thing once and it said, do it. It's way more useful if you can have this sort of nuanced conversation about, you know, even just the variation in the blood, in the measurements, or the, you know, the fact that there are studies that have looked at it, or the fact that, you know, the difference in the number of people who have four or more symptoms, difference between, you know, having, you know, being truly hypothyroid and just being euthyroid is not that big a difference. And so understanding that really helps that conversation so that you don't feel like you're just, you know, poo-pooing the whole idea.
Right. And just to put these all in context of what other people have said, there's just recently the Canadian Task Force for Preventative Healthcare recommends against screening for thyroid function and treating asymptomatic non-pregnant patients or treating subclinical hypothyroidism. It also, but as you know, the BMJ just released something, James, with similar kind of recommendations.
Yeah, it's a very nice review, and it gives even more detail about some of the studies and stuff that we've been talking about. You know, we're in the tools of practice. So we'll put links to all these things.
Right. And so let's sum it up. There are no randomized control trials for screening for thyroid function, like ordering TSH in non-pregnant healthy people. Despite approximately 20 RCTs, there is no patient-oriented benefits in treating subclinical hypothyroidism. No reduction in weight, no improvement in weight, no reduction in fatigue, no prevention of cardiovascular disease, and guidelines basically say don't do either. And I think based on either the absence of evidence or the absence of benefit in the case of subclinical hypothyroidism.
Yeah, and that's how you become the number one prescription drug in the world.
I don't know if that's exactly how you do it.
Well, no, it is. That is exactly how you do it, because it is. And
but it's no. When we're treating it for that, there are people with.
There are definitely people who are truly hypothyroid. But I would suggest, and actually, I don't know the numbers. I don't know if you saw this in what you were looking at.
No.
I still think probably the vast majority is for the subclinical.
Well, I hope not.
Yeah.
I don't see it actually that much in my. In my practice and that kind of thing, or like, because I do locums now, I don't see it in that. But I know that it never occurred? Am I sure that it never occurs? I'm absolutely not sure of that. I would suspect that there are some treatments of
And it's almost never sort of subclinical, because like you said, if you went through that list of the, do you have any of these things, I would like to meet the person who doesn't have any of those things. Right? So if you do the screening... It's they are calling it subclinical, but you know what I'm saying is it's.
I know that's because remember I said right at the beginning, if we're willing to accept this definition, can we go on?
And I know. Exactly.
That's the piece, because I don't think it's actually. It's certainly not that definitive. Anyway, tricky.
No, but great stuff. And you know, I think a really important topic, and I think you know, I appreciate that, you know, you and Jennifer did such great work of putting this all together, and. You know, really useful information to, you know, help clinicians with the best available evidence. So really cool. So just a couple of things. We've got our Best Science Medicine course coming up April 24, 25. I think it's 24, 25, 25, 26 of April. It's on our website. You can check that out. We've just about completed our, got all our speakers for that. So hopefully if you have any interest in coming to Vancouver or coming to the course, we'd love to see you there. Continue to check out all of the tools or practices that are being produced. anything else, Mike?
Oh, and the stuff from the National College, the College of Family Physicians of Canada. We're doing webinars and we're working on developing a new web-based certified learning that James is going to be involved with. So we're plugging along at that. There's a lot of checks and balances to make that happen, but know that we are pushing forward on that.
Yeah, cool. Okay, so I think we'll leave it at that. So thanks as always for listening.
Talk to you later.